to you live from Hawthorne, California. It's Thursday, April 19th, 2012, and this is the Hermetic Hour with your host, Pope Runyon. And tonight, we're presenting a discussion on magic and politics. Now, this is a controversial, difficult, and delicate subject, but one of crucial importance that needs to be explored and understood by everyone who belongs to a magical group, a lodge, coven, or an order, or is considering joining such an organization. Now, we will cover the influence of theosophy and its distortions, and that influenced Nazism, the anti-occult, anti-neo-pagan bias that followed World War II, and the danger of being tagged as a racist, and the problem with illegal drugs and underage sex in connection with occult pagan activities, the problem with Satanism, and the great 1990s satanic witch hunt, the problem with raising children in pagan homes, the problem of diminishing privacy and personal freedoms, especially the freedom of association. We will look beyond right-wing and left-wing democratic buzzwords into the reality of our diminishing freedoms under both liberal and conservative administrations, and how we, as magicians, can preserve our traditions and our practices in a politically correct world. So, tune in and find out how to avoid what no one expects, the Spanish Inquisition. Well, we'll start off this discussion by revisiting an editorial I wrote on this subject in the Seventh Ray, Volume 2, Number 3, Autumn Equinox, 1973, way back then. And most of this still applies today. So we started off and said, the secret initiatory society has been used as an instrument of political subversion and criminal conspiracy for the past 3,000 years. The notorious activities of the assassins, the thugs, the triad tongues, and the Union Course were not fanciful inventions of Sax Rohmer and Ian Fleming. These organizations were, and the latter two still are, even more dangerous than they have been portrayed. Charles Manson and his Helter Skelter cult shocked America with a mere score of ritual murders, whereas less than 100 years ago, one venerable thug in India boasted of 900 victims slain by his hand alone. Now, in light of this, it is easy to understand why law enforcement agencies all over the world show considerable interest in reports of the revival or the formation of such and similar cults. And in the case of the outright criminal fraternities, there is seldom any direct channel to lawful society. One does not write La Cosa Nostra for an information flyer, nor can one subscribe to their quarterly bulletin, and the Union Course does not sponsor lectures on the manufacture of heroin at French universities. And such outlaw secret societies are not only secret, they are also clandestine, covert. And with such rare exceptions as California's Hell's Angels proving the rule, it has also been noted that a degenerate syndrome of group paranoia develops whenever any element of illegal or extra-legal activity is sponsored. tending to transform the clandestine antisocial enclave into a criminal gang. An underground patriotic resistance movement that continues to exist after a cessation of hostilities often shows the same evolutionary trend. And examples of this are the Sicilian Mafia and the American Ku Klux Klan. In the area of covert political activity, it is not so easy to separate the innocent from the guilty in the fraternal spectrum. The long-standing controversy over how much or how little the French Masonic lodges had to do with the mounting the revolution in 1789 is too complex a subject to be settled in this editorial, but the undisputed fact is that they take credit for bringing about such a tragic, vulgar event, and that is sufficient to perhaps damn them by their own precepts. Now, I'll comment on that. We need to modify that a bit. Rather than shaping the rough-ash lar of the state with their tools, they shattered it to bits, or so they proudly claim with the slogan, Liberty, Equality, Fraternity, and Revenge for de Molay. Professor Adam Weishaupt's Bavarian Illuminati in the early 1700s was a more philosophical and less violent venture into fraternal activities in the political sphere. Weishaupt planned to initiate women, that was verboten in Masonry even today, and this alone might have eventually transformed his order into a hermetic lodge rather than a covert utopian political front. I doubt that, actually. It is interesting to note that even in Royalist Catholic Bavaria, all the trumped-up charges against Weishaupt were dropped, and he was offered the return of his chair at a Catholic university. And yet we still read tracts by right-wing propagandists linking the Illuminati with the Fabian Society and the Rothschilds all the way up to modern times. And that's not exactly accurate either. We'll get back to that. Not so innocuous or ineffective was the proto-Nazi Thule Society in pre-war Germany. Until recently, it was generally supposed that the philosophical rationale behind Hitler's Third Reich was the radical naturalism of Friedrich Nietzsche, but post-war research points to the possible existence of a powerful black lodge in the Nazi hierarchy, which may have had some reciprocal affiliation with the Japanese Black Dragon Society and a certain Tibetan Bunpo sect. Now, that is not true. Now, the magus of this order was alleged to have been Professor General Karl Haushofer, one of Hitler's close advisors. That's also not true. Haushofer was an influence, but the man was really Rudolf Sabotendorf. Here we have an example of a political mysticism on the rampage. And as nearly as can be deduced from fragmentary evidence, this apocalyptic cult was a nightmarish extrapolation from HPB's Aryan-oriented theosophy. Actually, the German version of it was called Ariosophy. Neo-Nazis in present-day America have accepted this sinister mystique and have been propagandizing the occult community with appeals for pan-Aryan paganists. Judging from the outraged reactions, their efforts are meeting with little success. Well, that was back in 1973, but now they seem to be gaining ground. Taking an historical overview of the above-mentioned examples, it should be obvious that magic and politics, like liquor and gasoline, is a formula for disaster. The socio-political atrophy of pre-Napoleon Europe offers some excuse for Adam Weishaupt's Illuminati, and even, if the reader is a confirmed egalitarian, for the French Masons. But of course, the Thule Society neither needed nor wanted an excuse, but now, after 150 years of so-called liberty, equality, and fraternity, any modern lodge master who conspires to grasp the sorry scheme of things entire by Machiavellian manipulations is either a monster, a charlatan, or a fool. If he should accept outside support, support for such an effort, he is a tragic fool. For he and all of his brethren may well be crushed like bugs when they have served their purpose. And that may sound dramatic, but by gosh, history bears that out. Every cult that has ever tried to mess in politics has always come to a bad end. Even if the political people they're supporting succeed, they still get rid of you. Now, internal fraternal politics is a major topic in its own right. Intra-fraternal politics is a major topic in its own right. So we will limit our consideration of it here to its broader socio-political implications. Proponents of occult and or pagan ecumenical councils conveniently forget that as incorporated churches, however small and poor, our greatest power and security lies in the fact that we have the same constitutional rights as the richest and the most powerful popular denominations. And technically we do, actually we don't, but technically we do. Any legislative attack on our rights is also a threat, and they will certainly, however begrudgingly, recognize it as such. It would therefore seem axiomatic that small esoteric churches should not endanger their recognized legal status by aligning themselves, however passively, with pseudo-religious groups who are constantly attempting to sanctify various illegal or antisocial activities, and yet, impassioned appeals for Aquarian Age solidarity continue to trap the innocent and the unwary. And no matter how reasonable such associations claim to be, the inescapable fact is that they are a benefit only to the weakest or the least responsible of their member organizations. For such councils are collectively judged on a negative rather than a positive standard. And the power and the influence of the Magical Lodge lies in a province beyond politics. As more and more of our rights are transformed into privileges, our economic freedom further eroded by a tax system designed to restrict upward mobility, and our cultural integrity methodically dissipated by programs that future anthropologists may consider to have been perverse, we find that we have only one sanctuary yet uninvaded, our temple. And as a religious fraternity, we still have the right to choose our associates and to conduct our activities in private. For the sincere devotee of the magical art, this is a treasure beyond price. And to jeopardize the sanctity of his lodge by involving it in criminal or political activity would or should be unthinkable. And this does not imply that individual lodge members are forbidden to support political candidates or parties of their choice as private citizens, or that if one or more of them should commit illegal acts, that the lodge must be held responsible, any more than the Archbishop of the Chicago Diocese was responsible for the crimes of Al Capone. On the grounds that he was a Roman Catholic. Now, even in our esoteric realm, the Order of the Temple of Astarte is far from impotent in temporal matters while we render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's. We still possess the ultimate resource that survives to confound the tyrants and the liberators, the eternal abiding truth, which history is always compelled to reaffirm. To Esteus. Now, that was what I wrote in 1973. Now, today that needs a few little corrections and a few little additions along with that. Now, the Illuminati, although no one has actually proved that the Illuminati were behind some of the activities in the French Revolution, it pretty much seems like they were. The Illuminati was not and never was truly a mystical or occult organization. In fact, the reason why it was exposed was because it was using masonry and using a supernatural, a mystical framework to get its political agenda across. and it was never right wing, by the way. In fact, the Illuminati was very, very, very much to the left. And in fact, you can draw a direct line from the Illuminati right on through to the Bolsheviks. And so there's no bloodline involved in the Illuminati. No, the idea that's completely antithetical to anything that Weishaupt or the Illuminati would have dealt with. The structure of the Illuminati was very much like communist apparatus themselves, and that's the way they ended up. Now, some of the correction on that. That's been proven, by the way, with research. Which brings up a point. There are groups today who venerate the Illuminati, and I'm not sure they realize that the Illuminati is completely atheist. It's completely non-supernatural. It is absolutely materialistic. And so this is an example of a completely political philosophy that masks, still masks itself. I'm not going to mention the particular organization today that is influenced by the Illuminati. I think you know who they are. And certainly not the Masons, by the way. George Washington would never allow them in this country. I mentioned the Thule Society, and the Thule Society was very political. In fact, when the communists took over Munich in 1920 and ran up the red flag, the Thule Society had an arsenal in their headquarters, and they formed a private army called the Free Corps, and they were somewhat responsible for driving the communists out of Munich. And then they took that red flag with the hammer and sickle on it, and they put a big whitewashed circle in the middle of it, and they stuck a black swastika in it, and they were off and running. Major officers in the Thule Society was Dietrich Eckart. He was a German intellectual, a poet, and writer, and a world-class drunk. I mean, if Oliver Reed was still alive, Oliver Reed would be the perfect guy to play Dietrich Eckart. He was this drunken poet that hung out in the beer garden, and here comes this firebrand German corporal with two iron crosses to his credit, shoving his head off, and Dietrich says, "Hey, young man, come over here, young man. We got a job for you." You know who that guy was. Now, the Thule Society did not, even though Sibotendorf, the head of it, was an occultist, but he was also a military man. They got all of their material from Arya Safi, from Guido von Liszt and Linus Liebenfels, and the new German Templars, and all their anti-Semitism and all the rest of that stuff. That was all, you know, already laid out for them. Rune magic, the whole business. We can't really blame Blavatsky directly for any of this, because when theosophy was developed back in the 19th century, it was to some degree, I would say anti-Christian, but it ignored Christianity, and it because it had so much sponsorship in India, it was more interested in the Eastern philosophy, Sikh Sant actually, and so this struck a bell with some of these German esoteric groups that wanted to be pagan. They wanted to go back to Nordic paganism. So they created their own version of theosophy called Aryasophy. And that was counterbalanced by a Christian version of theosophy that Rudolf Steiner started, called Anthroposophy. But it was the Aryasophy that eventually ended up with Willigut and Jim Weir and that bunch. And ever since then, now, however, the important thing that to realize about that is ever since then, after World War II, the after reaction set in, occultism and paganism were stigmatized by this Ariosafi Nazi thing. Really stigmatized, especially after the Holocaust. And there was an automatic knee-jerk reaction from intellectuals and from governments and police organizations and everything all over the world against it, against anything like this. Now, theosophy was tolerated because it was so big and they knew that, you know, and it had become a kind of a, almost a mainstream thing. But these anything else, any other secret organizations or private organizations that were pagan or even occult were stigmatized with this. And they still are, by the way. They still are. You still have to realize that if you're a pagan, there is automatically in the minds of what we would call rational humanist intellectuals, automatically there's the specter of Nazism, and we can't get out from under it. In fact, it was so bad right after well, 1970s, when we had the occult revival in the psychedelic era, right, Rose? It was this idea that Nazism and paganism were the same thing. It spawned a whole bunch of books. Morning of the Magicians was the first one. And then it spawned a whole bunch of books that I would just refer to as Nazi spook books. They were a big swastika on the cover, and this is Hitler's secret Satanism and Hitler's paganism and all this kind of stuff. And they were trying to tie the Golden Dawn into this. Well, this is ridiculous. The Golden Dawn is absolutely no connection with Nazism. Never did have, and never will have. Because it has, the Golden Dawn has in its outer order, its structure is, its Kabbalah is also Haaretz. It's right out of the Zohar, and it's Rosicrucian. So how could it possibly have any connection with Nazism or with Ariosafi? It didn't, and it doesn't. But some this mania got started as a result of the connection from Blavatsky to Ariosafi to Nazis and the Thule group. This created a feeling almost that anybody that was pagan was, or even anybody who was magical, was somehow or other they were up to something very subversive. Now, we still aren't out from under that. And this is why, right now, we have a very colorful character. And unfortunately, I have to say that I know the guy, and I kind of like him. I mean, he's likable, and he's very, very, very intelligent and all that. And he's posing as officer in the Golden Dawn with an Iron Cross on his around his neck and his Golden Dawn regalia. And he's over in Europe, of course. And you know, I know this fellow, and he's doing this just to really he's doing this just to call attention to himself and to do something outrageous so people will talk about him. That's all. I don't really think that he's that much into that, but this sort of thing we just cannot do. I mean, this is just really, really bad. And this, it's the same thing we apply to any kind of illegal activity that you know. I'm not saying that personal people in a lodge or in a coven or whatever, they say that the lodge master or the high priestess or somebody should tell them how to live their lives. No. What they do as private citizens in their own home, that's none of our business. But the organization itself should not sponsor or come out in any way in favor of any illegal activity. And I'm going to give you an example of this. I'm going to give you an example of it without mentioning the name of the organization or anybody involved, and tell you exactly what I'm talking about, so you'll understand. Now, in the 1980s, there was an organization, an occult organization, rather large, with numerous chapters around the country, and their philosophy, which was published and which they adhered to, their philosophy indicated that they had the right to do things that were illegal. And that, so this prompted, and had prompted over years and years and years, their members to do that sort of thing, and to do it in connection with the lodge itself. Well, three of these lodges were, they were meeting in private homes. Three of these lodges got raided, and it was a pretty serious situation. And a deal was made with the Grand Master, who resided out of state in another state. And a deal was made under the table with the government, and these people that were raided were let off the hook. But ever since then, if you go into one of these chapter houses of this particular organization, regardless of what it says in their sacred book, if you take a controlled substance in there and you get caught, you will be expelled from that order. And that order, says that the greatest sin is restriction, according to their belief. But believe me, if you belong to that organization, you go in there and you have anything in your pocket that's going to get the rest of the lodge in trouble, and they find it, you're out and you won't get back in. Well, that's the way it has to be, because otherwise they would have. So you see, it doesn't matter. You have. It doesn't matter how philosophical your breaking of the law may be. You're just not going to do it, because if you do, the world we live in is not going to let you do it, and so. That has to be realized. And also, too, I can't ask anyone to join a magical fraternity without assuring them in writing in that we will not involve you in any subversive or illegal activities. We won't reveal your name or your photograph without your permission. And we will not involve you, and we promise not to involve you in any illegal or subversive activities. We have to do that, and this is the way it has to be. Now, it isn't arguable. I don't think there's any argument about this, because the people who want to do this and want to involve you in it, they're not your friends, and they shouldn't be your brothers and sisters. They just want to get you in trouble. They don't care. They enjoy getting in trouble. That's what they want to do. And you can't permit that. So this has to be the way it is. Now, I want to explain something else, too, about this council thing that we're discussing. Back in 1972, a little bit before this editorial of mine was written, my mentor, Fred Adams, who passed away in 1980, at the age of 80, back a couple of years ago, Fred founded the first neo-pagan council. It's called the Council of Themis. Now, we had 20 organizations in this. It was a council of earth organizations, of goddess-oriented earth organizations, and this was 1968-69, and there was a pagan movement. It was just really getting underway, and everyone in the Council of Themis agreed that, you know, we were religions that supported the preservation of the ecology of the planet, and we were in the spiritual icon was the goddess, and we were earth-oriented religions, and we all agreed on this, including the Order of the Temple of Astarte, because we have the goddess Astarte as our patron goddess, and we're certainly for ecology and certainly for preserving the earth and all of that. So we were members of it also. Well, I was great, and then a friend of ours who had a larger organization than either Fred's Ferrer or my own, he had a magazine which had twice the circulation of the Seventh Ray, and he was the media director, spokesman, and the spokes platform for this Council of Themis, and Fred was the president, and I was the secretary, and so we were growing and taking more members one way or another, and then this group came on the scene, which called itself the Psychedelic Venus Church. They were up in San Francisco. And they were headed by a fellow by the name of Jefferson Poland, who had his name legally changed to Jefferson for Unlawful Carnal Knowledge Poland, and of course he didn't spell it all out. He just abbreviated for Unlawful Carnal Knowledge. And that was his legal name. And he began to initiate people into the Psychedelic Venus Church, and he was carrying on I don't even want to describe it over the radio. But he was involving underage girls and psychedelic drugs and a sexual rite, and all of this was being done in public. And I had listened to this same guy a few years before in a coffee house describing all of the advantages of being a professional agitator. And he'd been in the civil rights movement and going all around and they were feeding him and putting him up and paying him a little pocket money and giving him all the dope he could smoke and all of this and all the chicks he could have fun with. And he was telling us how great this was to be a professional agitator, and I remembered that. And Fred got very, very upset about this because Ferreira, he celebrates sexuality and we had in Ferreira we had a bunch of, they weren't underage, but I mean there was young girls and young boys and young guys and we were going out in the woods and having pagan, not orgies exactly, but we were doing the thing, and Fred's artwork was very sensual and all of this, and Fred was really, really worried. Because what Poland was doing was was really, he was trying to get us all in trouble, and he was a member of the Council of Themis. We had accepted it. Well, we asked our friend with the magazine and the larger church, we asked him several times, friend did, what can we do about this? We got to get this guy under control, or we should not have him in the council. And we kept getting put off, and we kept getting put off, and we kept getting put off. And finally, Fred was about to leave for the Grand Tour of Europe, and we got this circular from the Psychedelic Venus Church that they were going to merge with this larger church that had the big magazine, and they were going to become a, I won't say the term, they were going to become a grove of this other church. And Fred, I'd never seen Fred get mad. This is the first time I ever saw Fred get furious. He was about to go to Europe and be out of the scene for a while. He called up this fellow that ran the magazine and tried to get him, and nobody would put him on. He couldn't reach him, and he called time and time, day after day, trying to get a hold of this guy, and nobody could tell Fred where he was. And Fred finally told me, he said, "Polk," he said, "we have to expel these people. We got to expel them, because once they join that larger group, we can't get rid of them, and the council will be ruined. And we have to expel them." And I said, "Well, Fred, if that's what you want to do, we'll do it." So we prepared a memorandum and apologized all over the place and sent the memorandum out to all 20 members of the council and told them we had to do this for our own protection, for the council's protection. Well, we thought that the rest of the council members would understand. We were wrong. We were terribly wrong. We were painted as villains. We were painted, poor Fred, who's a feminist and believed in free love and believed in all these, Fred had done just about all of the stuff that these people had believed in more sincerely than the rest of these people. And they painted him as a villain, as some kind of right-wing monster. And basically because one group that was jealous of Fred to start with, and they had a particular orientation, and they just slandered us all over the place. And Ferraria and never recovered from it. And the Council of Themis, of course, fell apart, and that was the end of that. And then they started another group called the Council of Earth Religions, and that went on for a while, and eventually it became another group, which I'm not going to mention. But this other group, about 5 minutes? Okay, we had a little glitch there. Probably because I'm talking about a subject that is very, very controversial. But anyway, the upshot of this was that we expelled the Psychedelic Venus Church from the Council of Themis. And we did this with the best intentions and to preserve the council from the rest of us from being stigmatized with what these people were doing. And we didn't. We thought that the rest of the council members would understand. They didn't, because one of the council members, that people were very jealous of Fred, and one thing or another, they went on a rampage against us, which is, of course, exactly what Poland wanted to do. This is exactly, he couldn't have, this was his whole purpose, was to cause trouble like this. And, years and years later, we were vindicated because he, Poland, ended up doing hard time for child molestation. And when he got out of prison, he published a diatribe he wasn't even remorseful at all. He published a diatribe saying that he had every right to do it and all the rest of that, so we were vindicated, but it came too late. Fred, never did regain that the trust of the pagan community after that. But I still, I understand. I don't fault Fred at all, and of course I was right there with him. And I don't fault us either for doing this, because you cannot allow people like this who just want to drag you down, who just want to get you in trouble, to dictate, you know, what you're going to do. You can't associate with people like this, and it doesn't matter. You can agree with them, you can even agree with what they're doing, but if they endanger everybody, then you have to just sever relations with them. Can't let them in. One of the things, though, that I want to point out here is that one of the reasons we have to be very, very, very circumspect, and we cannot advocate things like Poland was advocating, is because in this country, and in most countries today, if you have a child in your home, your child or anybody's, in your home under 18 years of age, you really have no right to privacy, and you are subject to social services can come in your house at any time. They can knock your door down and come right on in. They don't even need due process. This whole business of child abuse and child neglect and child, I'm not saying it's gone too far, but if you have a child in your home, you don't have the rights that you think you have. And you have to be, you cannot engage in activities that your neighbors or that your, or the social workers or anybody think is improper. You can't. So therefore, you have to be aware that it doesn't matter really whether the Republicans are in office or the Democrats are in office. This sort of thing goes on all the time. Now, this brings us to the question of Satanism. You call yourself a Satanist, and automatically you are bringing down all kinds of suspicion on yourself. And I think we all remember, we all recall that horrendous satanic witch hunt that we had back in the 1990s, when people who weren't even involved in occult organizations or occult activities were being accused of satanic ritual abuse. And these children were making up these stories about this, and there are still, to this day, there are people, I don't know how many, but there must be at least 20 people who are still in prison as a result of outright lies that these children concocted on this sexual, satanic rampage that occurred. And these people have never had due process. They're still in prison, some of them. And the people who put them in prison, the therapists and the prosecutors, they've never had the answer for any of this. It's been proven over and over that this was all delusion, but they've never had the answer for it. So you have to realize that you just can't jeopardize your organization and your privacy or anything else by engaging in activities like this. And if you call yourself a Satanist, this is exactly what they're going to suspect. So, and by the way, anyone who calls himself a Satanist, as far as I'm concerned, doesn't really understand very much about magic anyway. But the thing that I want to point out too here is that it doesn't do any good to say that, well, that's the right-wingers and the fundamental Christians. When they get in, they do all this. But well, we get the liberals and we get the Democrats in, and everything's going to be fine. No, that's not the case. Both of them. Because for one thing, if you think there's a right wing and a left wing, and if you think there's a Republican and a Democrat view or point of view or whatever, you're probably wrong, because there's very, very little difference between the two. And even though with a right wing, supposedly, or so-called right wing, there'll be a little more emphasis on fundamental religion as a criteria, a little bit more. And whereas with the left wing, there'll be an opposite. They'll have an opposite take. But either way, you're not going to get any more of your freedoms back, regardless of who gets in. And we're losing our privacy, and we're losing our freedom and our rights more and more and more every day. It's just what's going on. And there's not much you can do about it, because society is becoming too complex and too interconnected. So therefore, we have to give the impression, at least, that we are law-abiding and that we are not being political, and that we are and you never want in either, no matter which administration is in, you never want to appear to be racist. And the reason why you don't is because if you appear to be racist, then you are you're going to lose your freedom of association right there. The only way you can maintain freedom of association is if you are absolutely clear of the racist stigma. And what I mean by freedom of association is this. You should have, in a private organization, initiatory organization, a private, like a magical lodge, witchcraft coven, or whatever, you should have the right to select your own the members. You should have that right. Now, if, however, if you give the impression that your selectivity is based upon racism, that right will be taken away from you, I guarantee it. Now, so regardless of whether you're a racist or not, this is just common sense. You don't want to get into that, and you don't want to support that. You want to shy away from that. So I'm saying that your thoughts are your own, and what you express in private is your own, but you certainly don't want anything like that connected with your organization. Now, that goes along with, we're in the Facebook generation now, and Zandri and I were discussing tonight that as good as Facebook is in so many ways, and it's been it's been a very, very good thing in many ways, but you have to realize that anything you put on Facebook is not private. It's going to go to your future employer. It'll go to your government, whatever. And you also have to realize that we have a huge, in this country, a huge security establishment. Now, we have a security establishment, government security establishment, that hires and top-level people, and computer people especially, in the millions. Our security establishment today is bigger than it was during the height of the Cold War. And you have to have, so in order to make a living, it's back to the way it used to be back during the Cold War in the aerospace industry. You couldn't make a living in Los Angeles unless you had at least a confidential clearance. You couldn't. I mean, because this, you had to, and it's getting that way again. We have this huge security, but now you need a secret clearance. And if you get ahead, well, bitch, you need a top secret clearance. And good Lord, if you're involved in any of these illegal activities or anything like this, anything suspicious, you can't work. And so if you belong to an organization that espouses any of these subversive or illegal or reprehensible things, you won't be able to get a security clearance or keep it. So that's a reality that we have to face. So consequently, we have to realize that if we are going to be able to have the privacy that is essential for a magical tooth, so we can observe the hermetic maxim to know, to dare, to will, and to keep silence. If we want to maintain our freedom of association, then we have to not appear threatening to any aspect of the establishment. We have to be of good report. We have to maintain it. And that's just common sense. So this is something that I know it may be upsetting to some people, but believe me, I'm not making value judgments about your personal beliefs, and I'm not making value judgments about your politics. And I'm not making value judgments about things that you think ought to be legalized. Maybe I agree with you. I probably do. I probably have some personal political beliefs that are, but I try not to involve our organization in them. Anyway, next week, right along this kind of line here, and talking about these controversial subjects and this sort of thing, next week we're going to review my master's thesis in cultural anthropology from 1980, which was entitled Magical Cults and the Rise of Neo-Paganism in Southern California. And that's got some really, really, really expose material in it, which we will try to present without, naming the names of the innocent or the guilty or whatever. But a lot of really good inside dope on this. And this thesis of mine will be available to associate members to study. And eventually we may publish it. But I think it's more the sort of thing that the associate membership might have access to. And so next week, from the archives of California State University, the magical cults and the rise of neo-paganism in Southern California, your old wizard, Pope Runyon. And until then, you're trying to keep yourself out of trouble. And I've given you enough things not to do, enough stuff not to do. And so we'll see you next week, and good magic.